Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 242 for May 16th, 2014. Corvettes, composites, and checkered flags.
Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, everybody. I'm standing here in a former Ford factory in San Francisco. I'm here with Kevin Justima, who is the General Manager of Product Marketing and Strategy for Volkswagen of America. And we have a lovely view of San Francisco across the bay. None of you can see that, of course, but we can. And we're here because of the new Golf. This is the seventh generation of Golf that Volkswagen is bringing out. And so, Kevin, this is your car. Tell us about it.
Great. Thanks, Gary. Here today, we're showing both not only our Golf with our 1.8 TSI engine and our new generation of our TDI clean diesel engine, but we're actually beginning our launch with the iconic GTI. And so today, what you're going to experience driving and what you can see here in static display is our Mark 7 GTI behind us. The Mark 7 comes to us in an enhanced version with more length, more width. It is lowered and has more spacious than ever. It is still a five-passenger vehicle, but it has more cargo room now than any midsize sedan.
So the GTI basically gave birth to the hot hatch phenomenon in the U.S. market, and you guys are continuing that with this product.
That's right. We define this category. From the instance we launched in 1983 until this Mark 7 generation now, we define the category of hot hatch, and we've been recognized in some of the award-winning awards that we have received.
So basically, you have a broad, enthusiastic base of people who really like to have a car that they can have some fun with. There's performance. You guys are offering this with a manual transmission, which has probably a pretty high take rate for this vehicle.
It definitely does. We estimate that's at around 20%. And sometimes goes even higher on some of our specific trim levels. And what we're very excited about for the Mark 7 is, for our enthusiast community, we come with what has been for two generations now, our 2.0T TSI engine. And in its new generation has 210 horsepower for the GTI, but we also have what the market has been demanding. We have a performance package available on the GTI now, which gives an additional 10 horsepower, has larger front and rear brakes, and available on top of that is DCC, adaptive damping.
So in the Golf sales that Volkswagen of America has, I was astonished at the high level of purchase that is with GTI.
Yes, I mean, GTI being the icon of the Golf family as well, has a lot of loyalists that continue to return to that brand.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the, I don't want to call it the ordinary, but let's just talk the straight up Golf. So what have you guys done to enhance it for this new generation?
Well, the Mark 7 is all new. Importantly, it is the spearheading of the MQB platform being introduced to the U.S. market and the whole U.S. portfolio. This platform is designed from the beginning to allow alternative powertrains to be planned in it. There's greater efficiencies in its build, and based on the proportions and what it allows us to do in pulling out the wheels to the corners, it being slightly lowered, it's a designer's dream for making a modern and fresh look for the Golf family.
And so you're saying alternative powertrains. So right now it's available with gasoline and diesel engines.
All right. It's the newest generation of both of those. The 1.8 TSI is a new generation and is being built in Silao, Mexico. It has 170 horsepower. And then we have our new generation of our TDI clean diesel, and that has an increase of 10 horsepower above the current generation, from 140 horsepower to 150, with the same torque rating.
So who do you believe will be buying the new Golf?
The Golf is a very versatile vehicle. I've mentioned some of the spaciousness of it that continues to increase. And we are in this urban setting here in the San Francisco Bay Area because it is that urban youthful dweller with a very active lifestyle on the side that is one of the core targets and core customers for our Golf line.
And we're not going to talk about it at this point, but you're talking about alternative powertrains. You're going to have an electric version of this coming out at some point. There'll be a wagon version of this.
That's right. That's right. This is just the start. We're launching with the iconic GTI, the other two powertrains for Golf. Later in the year, with the MQB platform, we are bringing our first all battery electric vehicle to market with the e-Golf. And following that, we have the Golf Sportwagon launching in the beginning of 2015, and the Golf R. We had just our third generation Golf R with the current Mark VI generation, and we won't be waiting another 3 or 4 years for the Golf R to come. It's coming right away as part of the launch of the Golf family.
Well, so I want to thank you, Kevin. It's been very interesting to learn about these new products, and I want to spend more time behind the wheel. So thank you.
Look forward to you doing that today. Now back to you in the studio, Gary.
Oh, here we are. So it is live in the studio, so we're back from San Francisco. Joining me this evening, Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press, making a return appearance. And for his first appearance on the show is Jeff Sabatini from Car and Driver. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I have a fast question.
All right.
That opening shot that you did in San Francisco, could we do that again, but do it like it was Mystery Science 300, where we make up our own little narration and make fun of the stuff that's going on the show, like, you know, challenging people to find a visual difference between the seventh generation Golf and all the generations of Golf before it?
Harsh. So what do you think about the Golf, Jeff?
Are you blind?
I think they treat that design like it was the Porsche 911. Well, they're scared to deviate from it at all.
It's the Porsche 911 for people who don't have a lot of money. And it's especially in the GTI. We've had the GTI through our office already, and it's a great car. I think the thing with the Golf is one of the things that you said to that gentleman from Volkswagen was that you were surprised at the high take rate of the Golf of the GTI versus the Golf. I think the problem that Volkswagen has, though, is the low take rate of the Golf versus the GTI. People just don't buy as many Golfs as they should, and they've been scrambling for years to try to, you know, make up for that with the Jetta, which is not doing all that well for them at Volkswagen. And I hope that more people can see the inherent goodness in this hatchback in this generation.
So you guys at Car and Driver are really big on manual transmissions, and I was very surprised the 20% take of manual transmissions for that car.
That's actually pretty high.
It's very high.
That's good.
And so my question is, you were alluding to the fact that there's not very many Golfs being sold. Could the problem be that people associate that with driving manual transmissions?
I just think it's that Volkswagen has a really hard time figuring out how to sell cars in the United States. You know, you look at their sales, like last year they were the only car company almost that sales went down when everybody else was going up. They just don't have a really good time in the U.S. market, and they never have. They don't understand the U.S. market. And, you know, one thing with the Golf is that the Golf, every time they bring out a new generation, it comes out in Europe, and then we wait like a year, almost 2 years, before they bring it over to the U.S. I mean, the first time I drove the Mark VII Golf was 18 months ago in Europe.
So it's been available there for a year.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and there's the fact that, I mean, I think probably like most people who write about cars, the three of us really like hatchbacks, but that makes us weirdos in America. I mean, Americans don't buy a lot of hatchback cars. You know, SUVs, station wagons, sure, you know, we know those are really, you know, things that have hatches too. But, I mean, America and China are the only two markets in the world where Volkswagen sells more Jettas than they do Golfs, because sedans are what people here like.
Right.
Right, so I'd ask George Peterson.
We buy a lot of iPads, though.
A lot of iPads. George Peterson, who is the head of Auto Pacific, and they do a lot of research, and I asked him about hatchbacks and why hatchbacks don't do well in the United States while they do very well in Europe, because they
should say hatchback cars. Notice how Mark said hatchback cars.
Okay.
Because we buy lots of hatchback crossovers and
okay,
SUVs.
Hatchback cars.
Thank you.
So according to George, hatchbacks are perceived to be the least expensive cars in the lineup. They're workhorses because they have an open and flexible second row seating and cargo area, so they can do the duty of a sedan and a small wagon. They are not in favor because they are perceived to be the least expensive car, perceived not as safe because folks think a trunk affords more safety in the rear end impact, perceived less secure because a thief can see what's in the cargo area and can break in more easily. And he's saying this is all perception. I mean, it's not.
Right. So, and it's all wrong.
Well, I mean, you...
These perceptions are all wrong, though.
Right. So...
But that's the kind of thinking that's the reason that Volkswagen can't sell cars in America. They keep telling customers that they're wrong about stuff, I think.
So, I mean, they've sold 30 million Golfs. I mean, the Golf quickly eclipsed the Beetle in sales. You know, that had been their all-time thing. But... not here. So it's very curious.
And it's the best-selling car in Europe just about every year. And it's a wonderful car.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't happen to be
right.
You know, the formula that sells well here.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of selling well here, you were just driving the Ram 1500 Echo Diesel. So tell us about your impressions of that car.
Man, it was a really pleasant surprise. Yeah.
And not a hatchback.
And I use car for just about everything anyway. It was a really pleasant surprise. I mean, it's just a little 3-liter V6 diesel in this big full-size crew cab four-wheel drive pickup. And it's got all the power that you want. I mean, this little diesel's got more torque than a 5.7-liter Hemi. And in this truck, it gets 27, 28 miles a gallon EPA highway rating. I mean, it just smokes everything else.
What did you get, though?
I was combined, and I was pretty much hitting the EPA numbers. I was getting about 22 to 23 combined. So diesels, in my experience, they tend, in real-world driving, not to have a lot of trouble matching or at least coming close to the EPA numbers.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm most curious about with this truck, it reminded me of how good the Ram is with, you know, the independent rear suspension and the available air springs and all the rest of it. But the thing I'm most curious about, this oh-so-dramatic 2015 all-aluminum-bodied Ford F-150, when that comes out next year, or later on this year, are they going to be able to beat the highway fuel economy of this, you know, little 3-liter diesel, you know, Ram? That's I want to find out.
But that truck, as you drove it, was not inexpensive.
No, God, no.
And compared to all of the ones that you compared it to, it was several thousand dollars more.
It was in the same ballpark, pretty much, as all of them. I mean, if you looked at it, the base price for it and the base price for all of the comparable models, it was, you know, a few hundred dollars higher. The thing that really is, you know, kind of a shock is that the diesel is a $2,850 option all on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And you need the big fuel economy improvement that they're talking about to justify that. Because,
right.
I mean, if you're not getting 3, 4, 5 miles a gallon better than the competition, there's no reason to buy that truck.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for them, they are.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, pickups in general, I mean, if you know, load them up, they get shockingly expensive. And, I mean, this was a $54,000 Ram pickup. I mean, it cost about what a similarly equipped version of anybody else's big pickup was, so I can't say it's a bad value, but it's still kind of jaw-dropping.
Mm-hmm. You had a chance to drive it, Jeff?
I think I drove it to lunch once.
Yeah. It left a big impression on you?
No, I'm not a huge pickup enthusiast, mm-hmm. would be the polite way to say that I don't like trucks.
Mm-hmm. So. But you are a big BMW enthusiast. Fair statement?
I am a BMW owner.
Okay.
Yes.
And so last week, BMW put $200 million into its the SGL Composites operation in Washington State, which is going to triple the capacity to produce carbon fiber.
Yes.
And they're going to 900 tons of carbon fiber, which would by far make it...
And when you think how light carbon fiber is, 900 tons is just a mind-blowing amount.
So why are they spending all this money?
Didn't they say that carbon fiber is no longer going to just be for M-edition cars and fuel efficient,
i8 and i3.
Hybrid electric type cars. Now their goal is to push this technology into all their vehicles to improve fuel economy.
And do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I mean that's everybody's got to have a strategy to improve fuel economy, and that seems to be BMW's strategy. It's like Ford deciding that they're going to build pickup trucks out of aluminum. Everyone's sort of, you know, rolling the dice on whatever they think is going to give them a competitive advantage. And since BMW seems to have this competitive advantage right now, that's what they're going to do. And they're at a competitive disadvantage against luxury brands like Toyota, Toyota's Lexus, which has all these efficient Toyota vehicles to balance their CAFE numbers. And BMW doesn't have that sort of volume in Mini. So.
And it's mainstreaming the new technologies, just the same as so many of the technologies that started off in hybrids, stop-start and everything else, we're going to see roll out into virtually every car that's on the road over the next few years. I think, you know, installing this kind of capacity to make more carbon fiber is just another sign that all of these technologies are going to become more common as everybody reaches for greater fuel efficiency.
So do you think that this will have an effect on the affordability of cars, or is it going to be a case where if you can afford a BMW, then you can just eat a little bit more to have the carbon fiber?
Well, I think I'm not as concerned with the affordability up front as the affordability of repair. Carbon, you don't just take your carbon fiber panel and, you know, slap some Bondo on it and go down the road. But I think BMW, you're right, BMW customers are used to paying through the nose, and this will just be one more way for them to do that.
Well, isn't Ford going to have the same problem with the aluminum?
It's definitely going to cost more. I mean, the first big, you know, expense is going to be for all their dealers putting in the equipment to work on it. But they say that they think
Fortunately, not all their dealers have body shops.
Yeah.
And that's...
I'm not sure that's fortunate, but it's true.
Well,
anyway.
It's fortunate. It is, because Ford's underwriting, they're giving some of the dealers money to upgrade their body shops. But no, it's definitely going to cost more. There's going to be a cost involved. There's always a cost involved.
Can you slap Bondo on aluminum?
I don't think so.
No. Is there an
just hammer it out, which is how they made Ferrari aluminum panels in the first place for years. Just have a guy pounding on it with a hammer.
Uh-huh. Well, I think one of the cases that Ford has made, which we'll see whether this plays out, is that aluminum is actually more resistant to sort of the little dings and dents.
Is that a real concern among pickup truck buyers?
That's kind of what I said.
Little dings and dents.
Yeah.
I think it's the large dings and dents from gravel and boulders and tree stumps.
I mean, those things are a badge of honor half the time.
You think? Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So beat up your pickup truck and you've
take arrived. A ball peen hammer to it.
Uh-huh. Well, going back to sort of pickup, so Mark, we were talking earlier, and you were out of town last week when the big Chrysler endurance event was going on. It was like, you know, Fidel Castro making a speech that goes on for 9-10 hours, but at least they broke it up with other people.
Didn't they give journalists medals at the end?
Endurance
medals. Just
for
finishing. Yeah.
So what is your observation on what occurred last week?
Well, first, I thought it was real interesting, and give them credit for laying out that much detail. I mean, a lot of what they talked about won't happen because there'll be mid-course corrections, and just like there were with the last plan. But I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was interesting that a lot of people seemed to fixate on the idea that the Chrysler 300 and Dodge Charger were going to be splitting up into two separate platforms, and the 300 would turn into a rear wheel or a front-wheel drive car. And that didn't make sense to me in the context of what was said in the presentations. I was watching from my hotel room on vacation. You know, great vacation day. You know, 9 hours in front of the, you know, iPad watching it. But I checked with Chrysler, and they said they're not even. Oh, thank you. It'll be just like being on vacation again. Yeah. But I checked with Chrysler last week, and they said that, you know, there hasn't been any decision made on separating 300 and Charger into two different platforms. That, you know, that is some ways down the road if they.
So they're going to put it on the Giulietta platform. Is they're going to put everything on it now.
Compact U.S. wide. I think the thing with every time an automaker rolls out some big grandiose plan, I think a lot of people get caught up in focusing on the details. And the details, you know, the details change. The details, and the details honestly don't matter. What you can take away from these grandiose announcements, like Volkswagen's announcement that they're going to become the largest car company in the world, and Ford's bold move strategy a few years ago to fend off bankruptcy, which actually worked. This struck me similarly in that it gives you an idea of what they're thinking. Because oftentimes the car companies, you know, they say all kinds of stuff, but most of it's not true. This is an opportunity where you can read between the lines and get an idea of where they're headed and what they're thinking. And the thing that I took away from this is that they want to make Dodge Pontiac, and they want to make Chrysler Dodge, or maybe Plymouth, and that they failed at making SRT a standalone brand. And, you know, you look at these things that they're doing, and it seems like a lot of unnecessary reorganization to me, just to make things sort of like fit into a mindset. And that is why I'm kind of skeptical of it.
I thought what I took away from it was the headline on the Chrysler presentation, the Chrysler brand, "Our time has come." What does that mean?
Well, what does any of it mean?
They're borrowing 1960s pop songs?
yeah. Possibly. But,
and Dodge fell for the leader of the pack. I mean, I don't know.
It seems somewhat unusual, that's for sure. So,
but particularly the Chrysler and Dodge stuff, if they can make it work, that's the kind of stuff that's almost impossible to really make it concrete when you're talking about it. You know, what's it mean to be a performance, you know, oriented crossover?
Sure.
You know, so, I mean, that comes down to the execution, and we'll know when we see the vehicles, you know, if they were able to pull it off or not.
Well, another thing that I thought was odd was that basically they're going to take, by 2018, they plan to reduce Dodge's sales by 10%. And increase Chrysler sales by 132%. So why take the one that's doing very well and subtract from it?
Well, and a lot of that is they're doing things like they're going to kill the Dodge Grand Caravan, which is like, you know, that's like saying that, you know, you're going to murder your eldest son. I mean, it doesn't make sense. And it seems
especially
like...
Especially if you're the eldest son.
Yeah. It just seems to me like there's a lot of this, like, let's reinvent everything. And, the dealers, I can't imagine that the dealers are going to hear all this and go, yeah, because they're looking at, like, what can we sell? Mm-hmm. What can we sell? And if you start moving brands and shifting strategies and taking everything in different directions, you're not, you confuse people who only come into the dealership once every 6 to 10 years to buy a new minivan. Mm-hmm.
But they had a set of brands and products that didn't make sense. And they had to do something. I mean, whether this works, and I think we all agree, there's going to be a lot of mid-course corrections between what mm-hmm. they said and what we get. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, clearly, it doesn't make sense to have two virtually identical, you know, minivans that you're spending twice as much money to convince people that they're different. If you know, why not have two vehicles that are actually different? Why not just have one really good minivan? You know, why bother keeping Chrysler around at all if it's just going to have, you know, a minivan and you know, a 300? I mean, it's a vestigial brand. It's an appendix.
It's their time has come. So.
Right. Yes. So I mean, it was a mess. It was a mess they had inherited from a long time ago, and something had to be done to clean it up. And at least they're trying to address it, I think.
Okay. So. Now, let's move on from that and talk about something that you guys don't want to talk about. Earlier, we were talking in the green room about the fact that today General Motors is recalling additional 2.7 million vehicles.
And it's not that we don't want to talk about recalls. It's just that we'd like to not name every one of the 2.7 million vehicles individually, if we can avoid that.
Come on, you were laughing. It was funny. but you guys made a good point about this, about... Recalls.
It's only funny the first and third time. This would be the second time. So
all right, so we won't share this. But Mark, you were saying that people are becoming too hypersensitive, and this could be an effect. And you were saying no one cares about recalls unless it's their car,
or someone's dying,
or okay,
and it's, you know, like there's a YouTube video of it,
or an eldest son.
And if they're the one who died, they can't care about it. So they're somebody you don't have to worry about.
So, okay,
that,
right? So let's go to your point about people.
Well, I just wonder. I mean, every company is justifiably very concerned that they don't, that they're not the next one that underreports something that turns out to be a real problem. And I think that we're seeing, you know, a certain, you know, level of, you know, over-reporting. The GM ones today that you were going through, I don't want to belittle them, because some of those sounded like problems that are potentially quite serious, and definitely you should bring your car in. But, you know, there's, you know, some others where I feel like car companies are looking at things that in the past they might have just said, yeah, when they bring the car in for service, fix this and don't bother telling them about it. And instead now they're sending out a recall because they don't want to be the next headline.
Get it with the technical service bulletin, you know.
The old way, yeah.
But the old way, but didn't that cause a lot of distrust about car makers when there were those bulletins and, you know, you had something wrong with your car?
Oh, I'm not saying they're good,
but
it's just how it used to be done.
I just think the distrust is just part of the system now. I mean,
so you don't think it's going to get better?
No.
Is it going to get worse or is it going to stay the same?
I think post-Toyota, I think that the inviolable trust, at least with the current generations of car buyers, has been broken, and that I think when you see these huge numbers and you see, you know, 2.7 million cars, I mean, that's like, even if you don't know anything about the auto industry, you're going to be kind of like, oh, that's a lot of cars. I don't see the situation getting better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so before we go to break, fast, the last thing you mentioned, Toyota, you guys didn't get a chance to chime in. What do you think about their moving their headquarters and whatnot to Plano, Texas?
I don't understand it. I feel bad for the people who live in the communities they're deserting. I feel bad for the communities. And when you see their executive saying that it's all about the relationships we have with our people, and our people are our number one resources, that really rings hollow when you're uprooting people like mm-hmm. this and telling a lot of them, putting a lot of them in the position to leave jobs that they care about.
Mm-hmm. I just think they should have moved to Ann Arbor, where they have a technical center, because Ann Arbor, Michigan, is the greatest city in the world.
It's where Jeff lives and works, by the way, so that's not a completely unbiased observation there.
I've never claimed to be unbiased.
But honestly, it would make more sense than Plano, Texas. I mean, at least they got a post office box in Ann Arbor now. I mean, they have a big, vital tech center there. They do real important work there. Plano, they just, you know, found a place where they could,
you know, they are moving. I think they are moving about 100 people to Ann Arbor.
Yes.
So Ann Arbor is actually getting a little bit of benefit.
But they're moving
from this.
Thousands of people to Texas.
Yep. Well, but, you know, this is the whole line of malarkey that we have in our modern capitalist system, where you've got, you know, let's throw, you know, tax rebates at these companies to get them to move here. And the company, okay. And they pick up and move. And there's never any actual accounting of the costs and you know, in human lives and any of that. And I'm going to go off on a socialist rant, so maybe we should go on.
Break. If Rick Perry gave you $40 million, would you move from Ann Arbor?
I wouldn't move to Texas for $40
million. Oh, I mean, he's not going to give you $40 million.
Governor Perry, if you're offering $40 million to move, I will move. It'd be Austin, though, got to tell you. It'd be Austin.
So the Free Press car headquarters will become an address in Austin, Texas.
$40 million? I'll find a way to make it work.
Austin has a newspaper, right?
All right. So we're gonna hear from Bridgestone Firestone, and then we're going to have a very special guest who brought a very special car to the studio, so do not leave. So, Ben?
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
It was a Subaru.
All right, so John actually isn't here, despite the fact he's not out in the parking lot talking with
his
iPhone in his hand.
He's not hooking that up in my car?
Maybe he is. And, so anyway, we've got our very special guest, as I promised. It's Jim Campbell, who is the Vice President of Performance Vehicles and Motorsports for General Motors. And he brought a little something along with him to the studio. And so, you know, I would say, you know, we got to talk about the elephant in the room, except this would be like the opposite of what an elephant is. So Jim, tell us about that car.
Well, they told me I could bring one car. And out of all of our race cars, there's so many cool ones. This one's pretty special. This is the Corvette C7R. This is C7R 001. It's our test car. It was in Escoda yesterday doing some testing at the airfield there, getting ready for Le Mans. We put the show panels on it this morning. But this is our original test car, and our two race cars are preparing for the big race at Le Mans.
So tell us a little bit about the performance that this car is going to...
This car obviously was developed in conjunction with the Corvette, Z06, and obviously a lot of learning came from our C6R program, its predecessor. So the whole program, if you take a look at it, it's a very integrated, aggressive downforce package, aerodynamics of this race car were developed in conjunction with the Z06 car that we'll sell in the showroom for the street. This obviously has a 5.5-liter V8 direct injection. We've got hood extractor here, aggressive spoiler on the back. This car is somewhere in the 480 horsepower, 485 horsepower under the hood. Straight line speed, it's up there. We got to run quick so we can run on the straights of Le Mans. But the whole idea is we've learned from the C6R program, its predecessor, to develop not only the Stingray, but also the Z06, and then the Z06 is how we spawned this C7R race car.
So, Jeff, you were going to take it out on a 275, but Jim suggested that might not be a good idea.
Yeah, we've got to wait for traffic to thin out.
Yeah, it has an extract six-speed sequential gearbox, paddle shifting, combined with the V8 engine direct injection. It's 4.4-inch spore spacing, just like a Chevy small block V8. It's just push rod technology, and it delivers a combination of power, fuel economy, and durability. And to win a race like Le Mans, you got to deliver that at the very least, plus great driving.
Well, and in the first year of this new car, do you think you got a legitimate shot?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have, we've been to Le Mans 14 times, and in our class, we've won it 7 times. So we have a good track record. With that said, the last time we won was 2011 with the C6R. The last 2 years, we did not win. Now, the C7R races in the new Tudor United Sports Car Championship. We're in the GT LM class, LM for Le Mans, we already have 2 wins. We won at Laguna Seca. It was the last race, and we won at Long Beach. The competition's tough. We race against Ferrari, Porsche, BMW, Aston Martin's at some of the races, Vipers at all the races here in the U.S. So it's a great category. I love this category. This was formerly the GT category out of American Le Mans series that came in the new Tudor series.
Well, and what does it mean for Chevrolet? I mean, a real heart of the market brand to have a car that competes with Ferrari and Porsche and Aston Martin. I mean, what does that do for you?
Well, I mean, for us, I mean, obviously, we learn a lot on the track that helps us build better cars for the showroom and the powertrains. It obviously, when you win championships and races like Le Mans, and you beat competitors that are just they're world class competitors, it does lift the brand image and the opinion of the brand for not only Corvette, but I think it helps Chevrolet overall. And good things happen. Customers put you on their shopping list quicker when they have a higher opinion of you. Obviously, we go to the racetrack, we have a chance to interact with our Corvette customers there at the track. And then because of the power of the Internet and so on, we're really connected to the Corvette community around the world. And they're tracking our every move on the track. We're able to stay in touch with them. And then we get to interact with prospective customers, people that maybe have always considered, maybe someday I'll own a Corvette, or maybe they own a competitive vehicle, and they see how we're doing on the track. Gives us a chance to, earn their business. So we love racing for those reasons. It really does help us in not only the technical side, but the marketing side.
So under your purview, it's not only doing Le Mans racing, but you also have the NASCAR
we do.
Sprint Cup series.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chevy has a long history around performance and racing. I mean, it goes back to the co-founder, Louis Chevrolet. Him and his brothers were racers at Indy. That was kind of their proving grounds. But that spirit goes on today. So we're involved in stock car racing in both the truck, the Nationwide, and the Cup level. We run the Chevrolet SS on the Cup side. We're involved in drag racing at the sportsman level with the Copo Camaro and a lot of sportsman racers of all sorts that run Chevy Power. We go all the way up to pro stock with a Camaro. And then in road racing, of course, we're in the Tudor series with the Corvette C7R. We run a Corvette Daytona prototype in the prototype category, the top category. And then also our group also works with other divisions like Cadillac, and Cadillac runs in the World Challenge series with the CTS-V race car. Mm-hmm. We've had a good run there with Johnny O'Connell and Andy Pilgrim. We run a Camaro in a lower class here called GTS. And then we're involved in open wheel racing with IndyCar. And we have, as I said, a lot of history in Indianapolis. We left IndyCar for a while. We returned in 2012. So we run, you know, stock car, drag racing, road racing, and open wheel.
See, and this sort of gets to your point, Mark, about customers of Chevrolet can see the SS, they can see the Camaro, they can see cars that perhaps are more acquirable.
Yeah.
You know, certainly that's aspirational, but, you know, so they have the possibilities of getting some of the stuff that you guys are racing.
Yeah.
So do you have the best job in General Motors?
I think I do. I love the job, but our whole team, I mean, to be able to, work on race programs, we work on performance parts, and then we have a group that does high-performance variants, things like the V-Series Cadillacs, work on things like Z28. We don't do the Corvette production car, but we do get to touch a lot of the great performance things. When you're in the auto industry, this is the fun end of the business for sure.
So is there inflow from cars like this into street cars, or maybe more to the point, the Camaro that someone mm-hmm. is looking at right now, is there technology that is available in the showroom from your racing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Corvette for sure is our gold standard of tech transfer, and what we've learned on the C5R and C6R program have made our production cars and powertrains better by far. So, I mean, one small example on the C6 production car, the way we cooled the engine, we brought the air in the lower air intake through the radiator, and we vented below the car. What we've learned from racing in the C6R program, the predecessor to this one, is, you know, you bring the air in through the lower air intake, we go through a tilted radiator, we come out a hood extractor like you have here, which basically, basically improves downforce and lowers lift. Those are good things when it comes to a performance side. So we drove that right into the Stingray. So the learning from the race program is one small example, a lot around aerodynamics, light weighting of parts. You guys were talking about, you know, the use of carbon fiber. On the Corvette Stingray, we're right now, in terms of mass market use of carbon fiber, we have a pretty good amount between the hood and the roof on the Corvette Stingray. We basically are able to lower the center of gravity and also adjust the weight distribution so it mirrors a little bit more what we do in the race car, which is roughly 52 rear, 48 front. So we're trying to take the learnings from racing and drive it right into production. Other programs like IndyCar, we're learning a lot around direct injection and boosting or turbocharging, and we take that and drive it right into our advanced powertrain. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we do learn on the track. It does make our cars and our powertrains better. I think Corvette's a gold standard for us at least.
Mm-hmm. So the composite use, so that's the customer car has composite.
Yeah. I mean, well, Corvette's obviously had a lot of use of composites. We've used advanced materials, but in terms of carbon fiber to, you know, scale it, it's very difficult to scale, keep the cost down, get your, you know, basically kind of mass produce it. It really is, it's a challenging thing to do. We're doing it on Corvette with the hood and basically the roof structure. And basically it's very lightweight, great for horsepower to weight ratios, which is what you want to improve in sports cars. But again, the byproducts are lower center of gravity, and then we adjust the weight distribution. So two benefits, which I think really, you know, bode well for the customer and their experience and how they drive it, and also its performance metrics. It's we learn a lot from racing that we drive right over to the production side.
So that's presumably why you do it.
Absolutely. That's one of the key reasons. I mean, we race for, as I said, for four reasons. One is tech transfer. That is absolutely critical. And I think, you know, Corvette's a great example. I call it a gold standard for us. And we're trying to get every series up to that level where we learn on the track and drive it into production, whether it's about the vehicle or about the powertrain or both. Secondly, we race because we can develop engineers. We take young engineers and we put them into the motorsports program. The gentleman that's running our IndyCar program, Chris Barabee, worked on CTSV. He did the vehicle integration on the ATS, which was the North American Car of the Year. We put him into the IndyCar program as our program manager. And so he's able to hone his leadership skills, his engineering skills. It's super competitive. You know, you're racing every, you know, few weeks. In that case, Chevy races Honda. And in 2 years, he's generated two manufacturers' championships, one driver's championship, and one Indy 500 winner with Tony Kanaan. So he'll go back to a production job in the near future, and he'll be better for his experience in racing. So that's a, you know, second reason. Then obviously the marketing reasons are, you know, pretty clear. When you win big races, you can, it does lift the image of the brand. And then finally, what I love about racing too is race fans get to the track early. They get there hours early, 5, 6, 7 hours early. They want to hang out. They want to look for some entertainment. So in the midways, we'll have you know, examples of our cars or trucks, our performance parts, our accessories, and we'll have the experts there to answer the questions. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to interact with Chevy customers and then also prospective customers. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea is we want to earn a lead and eventually want to sell a car, truck, or a part for sure. So those are the reasons why we race. I mean, plus we love it. That's the other part. We love it.
And talking about the engineers, I thought that was interesting. You mentioned the one guy who's in charge of the Indy program. Do you have a fair number of engineers who are at the various tracks and events who are, you know, involved with the teams working with them so that it's not just the top guy, but there's other people who are learning the pace of an improvement and the kind of thing that has to be done in racing?
Yeah. Well, it's a combination of people that go to the track, but also we have you know, individuals dedicated to the race program that don't travel to the track, but they're working on the program at our performance and racing center. Right now it's in Wixom, Michigan. We just announced here about 2 weeks ago we're breaking ground on a new racing and performance center in Pontiac, Michigan. So we're going to move that facility from a place where we lease the building to we're gonna, a place where we're going to build a building and own it. We'll have dynos and so on. But yeah, those folks are working on racing during the week. They don't all go to the racetrack, but many of them do. So, yeah, no, that's a true benefit. You get to the racetrack and you realize what it takes to be ready for that green flag, give your race teams and drivers the best opportunity to win a race, let alone a championship. When you go back to the shop on Monday, if you won, it's great. You better keep hustling. If you didn't win, you better dig in and figure out why. And that's what we do. So there's so many lessons in racing, whether you win or don't. You can really learn a lot from both those experiences.
And with the circuits, you know, like, you know, Indy and NASCAR, it's not just, you know, writing a sponsorship check to somebody to get the Chevy bow tie on the vehicle. You're actually involved with the vehicles, with the teams.
Yeah, in the case of IndyCar, we, you know, the reason why we reentered the series is their rule set was quite good because they selected a small displacement engine package, V6. They require direct injection and boosting. They run an E85 as well. So we like that because if you think about where the industry is going and where our engines are going, we're you know, smaller displacements. There's, in this case, a V6. A lot of use of direct injection in our powertrains, both current and future. And then more applications of boosting or turbocharging. So in that case, you know, we have an engineer named Matthew Wiles. He was an advanced powertrain at General Motors. We have a partner in IndyCar by the name of Ilmor, who is, has a long history in racing. We basically took Matt, put him in deep into the design of the engine because he brought expertise in direct injection. He had done studies about, you know, the efficiency of the combustion inside the chamber and had done some work around ethanol mixes. So he was a perfect candidate to pair up with, you know, our powertrain team in Ilmor to design a 2.2-liter direct-injected twin-turbo V6. And that engine went on to, you know, be pretty successful for the last 2 years. We've won 2 of 4 races this season. And the big ones around the corner, which is the Indy 500.
Yeah, I mentioning the building that you guys are constructing. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first read that release, my initial reaction was, gee, they're going to have this giant building for racing. But to your point of that's all about advanced engineering for what you guys are doing in terms of the passenger car side of the business.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have the tools in place to support programs like Corvette or Cadillac program, the IndyCar program. We obviously run in the powertrain portion of that. There's a number of dynos we have. We have transient dynos, which, you know, getting access to a transient dyno in this industry for racing is absolutely fantastic because it allows you to test the whole system, work through calibrations, and really generate benefit in terms of drivability for the racers, along with other benefits. And so that's a real asset. And so you have to have a facility where you can get that work done. In addition, that group also is going to be working with us on performance parts. So as we develop performance parts, whether they're powertrain related or otherwise, that's going to be a place we can do testing as well. Mm-hmm. So, we can't wait.
Performance parts, are you talking about not just the ones for the track,
yeah,
but, you know, the ones that would be available, you know, through your aftermarket?
Yeah, so for example, in our group we have a performance parts group. It's really, I mean, the heart and soul of it is around crate engines, transmissions, and controllers. We are investing pretty heavily around street-level performance parts, which would be suspensions, brakes, aero packages, and so on, stage kits. But when it comes to the crate engine or a crate powertrain system, doing that development work on the dynos is just absolutely critical for your testing and preparing for your emissions testing. So that group's going to help us do that. Now, for example, we have an E-Rod crate powertrain system, so you can get a small-block Chevy V8, the transmission, the two controllers, one for the engine, one for the trans, they're programmed to work together. And then we go to CARB and we get an EO, an executive approval or authorization to basically certify that engine to be compliant in the state of California. And then many of the other states follow that. So that's what our group does. And you've got to prepare properly. And so we're the only ones right now that have an E-Rod crate powertrain system. And that's partly the work that this group does.
You know, I've always been curious because people have put a small block Chevy engine in everything from like a toilet to a bar stool to any car. There's some instruction on the internet how to put a small block Chevy in it. How many crate engines does GM Performance Parts sell a year? Do you know?
We sell a bunch. I don't really reveal the number, but we are one of the market leaders because the popularity of the small block V8, the big block V8, and now our LS, our electronically controlled small block V8s, very popular. And the fact that we're working and doing the work on the controller, not only for the engine, but if you buy our transmission, right, the two work together, it makes it simple. It's basically you connect the one controller to the other, get the whole system installed, and you're ready to cruise. That is a real benefit for a lot of customers. So we're trying to do a lot of that work that in the past has been a bit difficult. We do it in-house, and we can do it because we got the expertise in-house to do it. But, you know, the small block V8, you know, the basic, tenets of that engine haven't changed since really 1955. It's compact. It's got high energy density. It sits low in most of the vehicles. And it just brings so many benefits. But it's pushrod technology, two valves per cylinder, 4.4-inch bore spacing on the small block. We do 4.8 inches on the big block. And they're easy to work on and adaptable. And the aftermarket industry has obviously, you know, developed a lot of pieces and parts that work with our small block V8. What we're doing is we're getting deep into that business, too, to make sure we're offering all those pieces and parts as well.
Well, like Gary was saying, I am a BMW owner, but I also own a 77 Corvette. And the one thing that I will say, unquestionably, the beauty of the small block Chevy is that it makes everything so cheap. There's been so many millions and millions of those parts built that, you know, repairs and just sourcing parts. For what you pay for an alternator for a 3 Series, you can pretty much buy a long block for a, you know, Chevy 350. You know, it's, yeah, and it's great.
I brought my catalog.
It's
I'm ready to go.
It's not cheap. It's economical.
Inexpensive.
Let's get the right verbiage there.
Okay.
All right. So we got a whole bunch of questions here. So I think we got to start the rapid fire portion.
Yep.
So these are from real people. So Ben, want to roll the rapid fire thing? Okay, so Roman Koch wants to know whether there'd be any interest in pursuing rally cars. Would General Motors be at all interested in that?
Mm-hmm.
And does it resonate well globally?
Yeah. Well, obviously, there's different categories of rally. You know, through our Opel brand, we do some rally work, some customer-based car programs that we actually do the engineering inside our Opel team, and offer packages that are already sorted and integrated for some of the more of the entry-level rally classes. The other series that's out there is Global Rallycross, which is a little bit, you know, is another alternative. We have one privateer who's running a Sonic. He runs a 2-liter Ecotec 4-cylinder turbo. So we're looking at those categories. Opel's in it for sure. You know, Chevrolet, in terms of Global Rallycross, we have some support on a privateer, but we're not in beyond that. We really are looking for, you know, series where we can really learn on the track and then drive that learning back into the development of the powertrain or the vehicle for the showroom. Global Rallycross is interesting and it's cool. It's like video game come to life. So I think there's real marketing benefits and elements. There's a really young group of customers that are following that series. We just don't offer an all-wheel drive, hardware on the Sonic. So, you know, we could do it. We just don't have that connection to the showroom. But it's a cool series. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. We have a question from, strangely enough, Jim Campbell, who met you at SEMA.
Oh, is that?
A couple years ago at SEMA, and you autographed his program. He loves it.
Hello to Jim.
So Jim Campbell wants to know from Jim Campbell is about the C7. Why is the left rear wheel stuck out a bit more than the right rear wheel?
Well, is that how it's looking on camera? Is that it? I mean, it's a fairly symmetrical car. The car fits right within the rules for, in this case, the car that's going to Le Mans fits into the ACO FIA rule set. And it's really the same set of rules that we run here with the Tudor series.
Okay.
So, it fits the rules it's symmetrical.
Not there, okay. Ben, let's bring in the telephone question from Delant. Change it up a little bit here.
Okay, yeah, sure.
This is Clem Zarobsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. I understand NASCAR has approved a new engine for Toyota. My question is, does Chevrolet have a new engine in the pipeline to replace the R07? And can you tell us anything that's going to be different about it versus the R07? Thank you very much.
Yep.
Bye.
Thanks for your question. We're constantly, listen, in racing, you are constantly doing development on not only engine pieces and parts, but also obviously the aero pieces and parts. So we do have submissions that we put into, you know, all the sanctioning bodies, NASCAR included. And they make a determination on, you know, what gets approved and what doesn't. But obviously, there's a number of things that we're looking at, not only for the full engine, but also the head. If we can't get the block approved, then we would submit, you know, a specific head design. But right now, those works happen, with NASCAR on an ongoing basis, like other sanctioning bodies. So that's about all I can say at this point.
Okay, we have a question here from DJ for Money. The data and video recorder that is in the Corvette now. I don't know if that's specifically your bailiwick, but he wants to know whether you see things like this going into other performance cars.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, for those of you that haven't seen it, this it's basically like a video recording of your drive with an overlay of telemetry. It is really cool. And it's really designed to help you, you know, really become better at taking laps on the track. So you can really see, you know, a lot of the key data about the car, your steering wheel angle, where your accelerator is, what's your lateral G's, all of the things, the telemetry we can pull from the car overlaid on a video of your lap. It is an amazing thing. So I think, listen, there's a lot of possibilities of where that can go. I love the fact that the first application of it for a production car is Corvette. So and Corvette tends to be, you know, kind of the tip of the spear. We try things there. If we like it, it works, then we look at how do you roll stuff out to other vehicles. And obviously in our group, we deal with everything performance, so we're always looking for those opportunities. So it's a great question. It's something that we're seriously going to look at.
Okay. And you guys can chime in with questions as you wish.
Well, I'm kind of curious. We were talking a little bit about NASCAR earlier. They've changed the format, obviously, for points and who qualifies for the playoff and all that. And it seems to have affected the number of individual race winners and everything. How are you finding it, you know, from a sponsor as far as the attention it's getting? I mean, your teams have done pretty well as far as the number of wins you've racked up. What do you think about the new format?
Well, first of all, I think it's actually quite good. It puts a focus on winning. You know, before you had basically 10 drivers that would get in on points, and you had two wild card winners that were basically who had the most wins, essentially. What they've gone to is now 16 slots are reserved for the chase for the championship. So if there's 16 individual winners, if you win, you're in. And basically, if you look at the history, there's been only a couple times when there's been 16 winners in the past, call it 15 years. So the chances of you getting in, if you win, are very high. So pretty much the drivers that are in are going to be in the chase for the championship. For the remaining slots, so let's say there's only 12 winners, then they'll go off of the points. So what I like about it is a total focus on winning. And obviously there's this thing called points racing, which if you're running in the top, we'll call it the top 10, you want to make sure you secure that finish for points. What these drivers are thinking about now is, how do I win? Because if they win, they're in the chase for the championship. Now, if you don't win, you do want to have the highest number of points, because that will that'll determine how they fill the remaining slots.
But putting a greater value on winning is making it more dramatic.
Yeah, I think so. And then the other dynamic that's happening is, Kevin Harvick has a couple wins. Anybody who has a win now, Dale Jr.'s got a win. Kurt Busch has a win. The list goes on from the Chevy side. Jeff Gordon got a win this past week.
Last weekend, yeah.
So now when these guys get to the track, what are they thinking about? I have nothing to lose because I'm in the chase for the championship. I'm going for the win. And so we saw that with Dale Jr. and Steve Letard as crew chief. They've gone for it, where in the past they might have just gone for more of a points play. I think it's exciting for the fans.
Second place is just the first loser, right?
Well, that's right. And now if you win, you're in the chase. That makes all the difference. Takes a lot of pressure off the team, and then those teams are going to be more aggressive on the track. Plus, they can focus on things like development. How do they prepare for the chase? I think it's very exciting. And then when you get into the actual chase, it's almost like a four team eliminator. You'll run I think it's three races, and basically they'll eliminate four teams, and then run another three races and eliminate four teams. So you get down to the last race where you'll have four racers that will be able to run for the championship in the final race in Homestead. So I think it's exciting because the focus is on winning.
So what's more important, winning the Daytona 500 or the Indianapolis 500?
Well, that's a great question.
For you guys,
guys. It's interesting because I've written this down. I actually wrote this down today. I was sitting in a meeting and I wrote down the big races. So obviously, winning the Daytona 500, Dale Jr. won that with the Chevrolet SS and the 88 Chevy SS. But think about all the big races. 12 Hours of Sebring, the Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona. Those are big in the sports car world. Indianapolis 500, 24 Hours Le Mans. I mean, there's more than that for sure. I think there's something special about Charlotte as well. But the Brickyard 400 has a lot of specialness to it. But if I had to kind of say it, half a dozen races: Daytona 500, 12 Hours of Sebring, Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona, Indy 500, the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And right now, we won the Rolex 24 Hours. At Daytona with Action Express, the number 5 Corvette Daytona prototype team. Dale Jr. won the Daytona 500, and the next few weeks we'll say a lot. We have the Indy 500 weekend after next, and the 24 Hours of Le Mans right around the corner in the middle of June.
Do you go to all the races?
I go about 35 weekends a year. I'm at the track, and I try to go to the races where there's we have multiple races going on where I can see more than one of our programs. So if we go to a Long Beach, Chevy's running an IndyCar, Cadillac's running the World Challenge along with a Camaro and GTS, and then our Corvettes, both the Daytona prototypes and our yellow Corvettes here, the GTLM C7R races there. So in one weekend, I can see a lot of our programs racing.
But it's
fun.
So if you were recommending to our viewer,
yeah,
and they could afford to go to one race a year,
mm-hmm.
okay, just one, and it could be anywhere, what race or weekend do you think would be the best?
Well,
this is for a normal person, not for somebody who's in the business.
I think that first of all, the question's not fair because there's so many just amazing races. But I would say Long Beach is an amazing race because you get this combination of this amazing kind of festival that's going on where you have these passionate fans along with people that don't really know much about racing but kind of are there for the festival and they discover racing. So I love that. And you see IndyCar, you see sports car racing with the Tudor Series, and then World Challenge. That's a great one. I don't know. Indianapolis 500 is a special thing. It is a special place. It's the history. It's the tradition. It's a pageantry before the race, and then to see what it takes to win the 500, it's special. It gives you a chill to be there. And then if you can't go to the 24 Hours of Le Mans, you can watch it on TV, watch it online. For the past few years, we actually, in both of our Corvettes, will have a kind of a live feed camera. And so you can ride shotgun with our Corvette team for 24 hours. If you've got the endurance to stay up for 24 hours, you can run shotgun with either the 73 or the 74 car. And in 2011, the 73 car won with Tommy Milner, Antonio Garcia, and Olivia Beretta. And it was a great ride. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I'd invite your viewers to check it out here in middle of June.
Okay. You guys got any other questions for Jim before we wrap this up?
The Indy engines. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ford managed, through brilliant marketing, Ford managed to convince most of the world that they invented turbocharging and directed fuel injection. Shockingly, no. Volkswagen had sold a million of them before Ford sold one EcoBoost, and GM had sold quite a few as well. And the Indy engine is a real interesting play, I would think, to catch up, convince people that you've got the engine technology. I don't really know what the right way to put it is, but are you at the point where you're able to build on that with the street cars now? Are you seeing a transfer between the success you've had in Indy and the vehicles that you've got on the road?
Yeah, I mean, we're on a 2.2 liter V6 direct injection twin turbo. So direct injection technology through our many of our powertrains, really communicating the benefits. That's racing can show that can be a technology that's fantastic for the delivery of power, fuel economy, efficiency, and still be really durable, combined with the turbo, the twin turbo in this case. I mean, the V6s run twin turbos, and our four cylinders we run single turbos. So I think racing can be a great way to showcase that technology, and then the translation to the showroom is important as well. Obviously, on the Cadillac side, we've got a twin turbo V6 in our Cadillac CTS, the V Sport. It's a rocket, 410 horsepower. But when you're just cruising around town, it's easy on the fuel. It's got great fuel economy. But when you get up on the wheel, you got the power when you need it, and that's really the benefit. But, yeah, we've got to get the word out and communicate that racing can help us do it.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for spending time with us this evening and for bringing in this marvelous-looking car. And so best of luck to you in a couple weeks in Indy, and maybe it's even less than that now.
Yeah, it's just qualifying this weekend. Tomorrow's Fast Friday. Qualifying Saturday and Sunday. It's a two-day process. Indy 500 is the 25th, which is the following Sunday, provided the weather holds for us. And then middle of June, I think it's 14th and 15th, 24 Hours of Le Mans. Catch it on the internet, catch it on TV, and you're going to see some of the most amazing sports car in the world running an 8.5-mile course in Le Mans, France. And it's got a lot of history, too, there. It's a tough race to win. We're going to give it our all.
Great. And Mark, I want to thank you for coming in, and we can see your stuff in the free press at freep.com.
Absolutely, thank you.
And Jeff Sabatini, Car and Driver, see your stuff, carandriver.com.
Carandriver.com.
And there you go, and my stuff.
Or hey, there's this other thing called print magazines.
Print magazines.
They actually still exist.
Yeah.
You can go to someplace bookstore, buy one.
Books.
Oh,
okay. You can get my stuff on autofieldguide.com. Okay, friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. So, okay, John will be back next week, and he'll be sitting here. And our guest will be Corey Wells, the director of the documentary 32 Hours, 7 Minutes. And we'll see you then. Thanks for watching.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.